The yellow flag has been shown. The red flag is being taken away. The lights will go to red. For the last time this season, the lights change.
Away they go. Good start from Danny Pedrosa. When we never said that.
Hello and welcome to Motorpod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 306 for Wednesday, the 15th of February, 2012. My name is Jules Cisek. I'm in California with Jim Race. Hey, Jim.
That would be me, Jim Race. How you doing, Jules?
Doing good.
Another interesting audio adventure this week, perhaps.
Yeah. We spent the last 30 minutes tuning stuff, and we did it mostly so we could do this.
Oh, that sounds like a Guinness.
It is.
Oh, I can hear the nitrogen. Well, okay, hang on. See, as how I'm not using my very, very high-tech mic, I'm going to have to... This may actually splatter the screen.
Ooh, nice.
Yours was better. Are you sure you just didn't play that back in the background from one of your, your sound clips?
Not yet. Next show. Also, happy birthday to Valentino Rossi tomorrow.
Absolutely.
What is he, going to be 33?
Yeah, I don't think he's in the Loris Caparossi school of defining his age yet.
Right.
Ooh, that was mean, wasn't it?
A bit.
This week, the surprise of surprises, we've got probably no interviews. You never know. We may end up with one before the show gets edited, but probably not. So this is going to be a whole bunch of Jules and I talking heads, but there is, Jules, a ton of stuff to talk about this week, isn't there?
There is. We got lots of news from PI, lots of little bits of news that are going to be really fun to talk to. I can't wait to talk about the BSB stuff. But I also rounded up like a bunch of listener email that's been kind of piling up that some of it you guys kind of touched on in the last show, but I think it deserves, like, you know, the full Monty.
That's a very interesting technical term for a text, but I think I can run with it. Before we do that, I have been remiss in talking about the donors that we've had in large and small, and I don't want to leave you guys out. So I'm going to run down a list here of folks that have, and I'm just going to go over the last month because I'm not sure if I've covered anybody. Raymond Jepson, William Crothers, Eddie Purick, hopefully I pronounced that right, times two, and I think I may have mentioned him before, but he actually donated 2 weeks in a row, and I thought that was the coolest fucking thing ever. Jeffrey Leake, Andrew Cole, Martin Gurney, Chaz or Charles Lee, Paul Pacey, as ever, Graham Barton as well, David DeHetcher, and Peter Newell. And I also want to throw a thanks out there. Even though you didn't throw me any money, but he has massively in the past, a classic patron of the show. Alex Baverold, our Frenchman friend from New York City, because he sparked a brainstorm, Jules, that I've had over the last few weeks about trying to figure out how to, you know, keep this show going. As you all know, it costs us a few bucks to put together. And certainly if we want to get to the races.
Yep.
And I got a thought. And my very thought is it's more direct interactivity. And that means giving you guys out there the opportunity to interact direct with myself or Jules or Martin live. And occasionally some of the racers. And that would in turn be moved, recorded and moved into the show. And your guys' questions might be put onto the air, talking with the actual people, be it ourselves, who are a bunch of dorks, or with the guys that we talk to all the time that I know you guys would love to talk to and ask some questions. I'm just going to put it out there. That's that. If you guys think that might be something interesting you'd like to be involved with, give me some feedback. I'd be very curious what you're thinking.
Yep. Yep. The actual technical parts of it, we're still trying to iron out, but it's, you know, we can figure something out.
Mm-hmm. We're good that way.
Yep.
Propeller heads, right?
Speak for yourself.
You got a pocket protector somewhere, I know.
Never. I don't even have a pocket, dude.
All right. You want to dive into listener feedback?
Yes, let's do it. Okay. Carl Hunt wrote in about TT3D. He said, I just got around to watching TT3D for the first time. The film tells a brilliant story, but I can't help but feel it's a little shortchanged. For me, the TT is about the sound of wailing superbike engines reverberating off townhouses as the bikes go by at 150 miles per hour. Plus, I'm seeing how hard the riders have to work to get the bikes around the bumpy TT course. This is something I feel you guys understand too, as I remember an intro to one of the TT shows you did last year featuring the aforementioned wailing bike engine sound, which actually you recorded there, Jim.
Yep.
That was awesome, and in a couple of seconds you summed up the TT better than 90 minutes of TT3D. I think the issue is that not enough race footage is shown in TT3D on board or otherwise, which is a real disappointment, as 2010 was the year that ITV started using the super slow cameras, super slow-mo cameras on the island. So surely a deal could have been done to use some of this awesome footage to see how hard the riders and bikes are pushed. My question is, what do you guys think? Do you think the film has kind of missed the mark? I wonder why the film wasn't made into 2 hours instead of 90 minutes and include the footage that we would like to see to complement the story. But thanks. That's good feedback, because, you know, normally people just watch the film and go, ooh, boo. You know, it's a great film. I actually share what Carl had to say. I was disappointed that we didn't see those things, but I understand, because it's a licensing thing. I know that when Mark Neal was working on Faster, he had a real tough time getting the footage from Dorna.
Right.
And he got in trouble for, you know, bringing a broadcast quality camera to the track a few times as well. So, I mean, these racing organizations, they make most of the money from the TV deals, and they really feel like the video is like their biggest IP, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably what happened, is the producers of this movie, you know, they may have gone to ITV and said, can we have this footage? And ITV said, no, you know, simply, or let's see next time. Maybe, you know, if you guys do, let's see how this movie does, you know. To me, the biggest disappointment about the movie is that we still can't get it in the States, you know.
Well, you can. I mean, you just
If you have friends over in the UK or buy from Amazon.UK, for example, which is what I did.
Exactly the same here. You and I were joking back and forth. How many times can you change the region on your DVD player before?
Exactly. But the thing is that I would love to see it on the big screen, right? And it's not being screened in the States. I could take my DVD and project it on the big screen, but it's not the same. I want to be able to see it with a bunch of people and that, you know, of like mind on a big screen, and that sucks.
Yeah, I'd like to see a double bill, and it would take some very hardcore enthusiasts to do it, but a double bill of TT3D and the full version of Charge.
Yes.
Played together on an afternoon.
I would love that. That'd be great.
That would be killer. You know, Mark had the same issue with Charge. It's actually not ITV4 that controls the footage. It's North One, who is the production company.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And there's some interesting stuff going on with that I'll talk to you offline about, because I'm trying to help somebody get some sponsorship over there. It really is a conundrum in trying to work with these companies. But I think in the end, it's going to be in everybody's best interest to build the viewership for the sport and put it in. But wresting control from them of what they feel is basically their golden goose, you're right. And of course, you're right, Carl, too. In a way, it's difficult to get that out. Well, the fact that we even have the kind of movies that we've been getting lately, frankly, is a big difference.
Yeah, it's a good start for sure.
Yeah, and so maybe what this is doing, it's breaking the eggshell so that we can actually get to the yolk. And if we can figure out a way to keep this kind of momentum going and build the entire production, not only just for the television companies, but for the sport and the show as a whole, everybody will realize it's in their best benefit to actually, Jules, what's the term? Open source journalism, right?
Yeah. Oh, social journalism, I think.
Social journalism. Yeah. But
well, the other thing I wanted to mention is that the second time that Mark made a movie with Dorna, it was a totally different thing. And so Fastest was completely supported by Dorna. Dorna gave him all the footage that he wanted. They let him be there at the track. And it was a completely different thing because he was now proven. I think that a lot of these, this kind of a thing is like, you know, you have to kind of prove yourself. And then, you know, unfortunately, a lot, like, even Dorna, who is pretty savvy, they still were a little bit on the back foot about new media. This documentary that was being made on the side, and it's hard to break through, I guess, you know.
Well, Jules, how long did it take for them to go, oh, you're a podcast, but you actually don't
yeah.
really doing.
Well, let's not bitch about that because they did.
I'm not recognizing it.
I'm
not bitching about it. They came down and frankly, they're probably one of our best allies at this point.
Totally.
Who else? Big John Hart finally wrote in. Poor Martin, I think, was only Jules. it was funny too. We've been having some great email conversations lately. You guys have been very prolific in your writing. Big John Hart writes in. Think about it. Even in the perfect MotoGP world we all want, if each major racing manufacturer, you know, Ducati, Kawasaki, Yamaha, Suzuki, Honda, etc., MV, I'll add into that maybe. Supplied two factory and two satellite machines, it would still be only 20 bikes. How big a grid do you want? Moto2? I think the CRG teams could bring interesting twist to things. If nothing else, it might be a way to economically lure some manufacturers back into the fold. I will agree, and I think we're actually seeing that with...
especially Aprilia, I think.
Especially Aprilia. Well... because it's a MotoGP bike with mirrors. I've been saying that forever. bringing Kawasaki back, and we've got a ZX Tangent-based production engine in there.
Yep, and the long, long, long promise of BMW we've been hearing for, you know, a decade.
Exactly. Well, and we've got Suter, this, you know, Colin Edwards bike with BMW in there. It's happening, and... here's the thing that I was saying, because we got a lot of email about CRTs and, you know, is it good or bad? My thought is, and this harkens back to when you and I, Jules, a couple of years ago, were talking about the transition from 250 GP to Moto 2. And in the beginning, both you and I were like wailing. We're like, no. And over time, we realized that this is what's going to happen, and we can either accept it or we can rail against it and decide that it's wrong before we've even seen how it works out. And what we've at least seen, and there was a great article on Superbike Planet, we should link to that, interview with Livio Supo.
Excellent.
Yeah. And Livio basically said the same thing. He said, this is reality, and this is what we have to deal with. So we might as well deal with it instead of being a bunch of babies, which is essentially what he said.
Right.
And learn how to work with it instead of fighting it. And Livio also said in there, he admitted very straight up, and you got to admit, he was, you know, a Ducati, a factory, of course, an employee for quite some time.
Yeah.
That... the factories do not have what they have before. And I think that's admitted and understood by everybody. And certainly Carmelo Ezpeleta has said it more than a few times. The MSMA no longer has the clout that they had before. And Carmelo is, for better or worse, and I think he's doing a very interesting job, and I'm willing to wait and see how he does, the helm of the ship. And so we are along for the ride. And if we love the sport, and we trust that they will still continue to deliver us fine quality entertainment and some great racing, and we better get on board. You know, the ship is heading out of port pretty soon, and we can either, you know, wave it off, or we can see how it works out.
Yeah, exactly. Another writer, Bryn, and we got no last name, so just Bryn. Wrote in that on the same topic. Interesting to hear various views on the introduction of CRT. Personally, I think it will push the boundaries of prototypes even further, as there is no mass market or production trickle down for teams to be distracted by, which is an interesting point. Yep. Teams will focus on winning. Factories will focus on compromise. Carbon frames, rotary engines, inboard brakes, telehandled suspension, twins or triples. Who knows what a CRT might come up with that would not translate into a road bike sale, so factories won't adopt. I look forward to the creation of new heroes that run successful teams and pick and choose technologies, riders, parts, without corporate ties dictating. This is what Team Roberts needed when they were on their own against the factories. The next 5 years will be a good time for MotoGP. I really like what Bryn had to say there.
Yep.
I really like that one sentence. Teams will focus on winning. Factories will focus on compromise. It's very true. I mean, yeah, of course the factories will support their own teams, certainly. But I think we're going to... I think that in 3 years, we're going to see some really proven... I mean, some interesting designs proven, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay, and I'll agree with you there, although the inboard brakes comment thing, Bryn, that ain't going to happen, dude.
Well, okay, he's just making a list of crazy stuff that somebody's going to probably try, you know?
I'm totally teasing about that. We're starting to see some of that innovation occur, although not in such a radical sense within the Moto2 ranks, and it's not something that you can actually necessarily see from a casual viewer point of view. But there are things that are starting to occur in the Moto2 paddock with the frames that are fairly funky. And there are some, considering the limitations they have there, we haven't even seen Jules yet because nobody's tipping their hand what kind of wacky shit some of the Moto3 guys are coming up with, because they actually have license to kill.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling when we start seeing fairings off, we're going to see some very, very cool stuff. Now, certainly the first year, people are going to go with about the most conventional thing they can, but that is a class that's going to be really fun to watch as far as innovation goes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And some of it may end up, you know, making it up the ranks.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and if we look at it, Jules,
it's a great testbed for some of the more expensive stuff that you have to do for this, for a CRT and MotoGP.
Yeah. And it's a lot of it's many, many, many of the same companies that are actually supplying both Moto2 bikes and the CRT grid. So, right. I think the whole thing is a very forward looking test bed. And for those that say that we don't have prototypes, I want you to look beyond just the MotoGP rank. I want you to look at all three classes and look at them as a whole and see the changes that are occurring, because they're very dynamic and they're happening very quickly, and kind of envision that. Those of you that only focus on the MotoGP ranks might be getting a skewed impression of how much innovation is actually occurring within that paddock. There's a lot of crazy shit going on.
Right on, brother.
Yep.
You do the Jim Jackson one?
I got to scroll here and okay, Tim Jackson, right? Oh yeah. This was cool, and I always appreciate it. Simon Crafar, I have a feeling you're listening these days to the show. He says, I recently purchased Simon Crafar's video book on the dark art of performance based on the interview you had with him a couple of shows ago. Wow, what an instructional video. It was by far the most in-depth look at track riding technique I have ever seen. And I take that comment interestingly because he carries on, and this is something that I do have experience with, because I haven't seen Simon's video yet. He said, what I found most interesting was just how different it is from the other great racing mainstay, Twist of the Wrist 1 and 2, and Soft Science. I've completed levels 1 through 3 at California Superbike School.
Me too.
And he said, at PI, fucking fast track, dude. as a lot of people have discovered this week, Jules, He says, I have the books and videos. One of the main points of difference is when Simon talks about body position, CSS, California Superbike School, teaches you to use your legs to effectively lock yourself onto the tank. In this way, you can be very loose on your wrists. Simon says, no pun intended, I thought it was funny, that you should keep your body as far forward as possible that you can under braking and during the turn. He says this because, A, it takes much more effort to hold yourself up in a position with your legs, and B, it's safer to, you know, on turn-in, as there's less body transference of weight. Very key, because that makes, Jules, that makes for, you know, smooth, very smooth transference between front and rear, and therefore less dangerous coming to a turn-in point. And C, keeping your weight forward helps stop the wheelie problem. He further carries on, the CSS method kind of makes you push back from the tank so your legs properly lock in place on the tank and foot peg. The problem is, as I see it, if you keep your weight all the way forward, as Simon suggests, it is hard, especially for a 6'2 rider like me, which would be exactly what I am, to get that really nice lock in the tank. You never get using the CSS method. However, when I look at the styles of the GPI riders, I often see that they do exactly what Simon suggests, that they look like their outside legs are not locked in and are visibly disconnected from the tank. I've never really understood this, or what the right technique is. Even the Tornado, that being Colin Edwards, looks like what Simon describes, and he's relatively tall and solid rider. My question is, when they're doing this, how do they lock themselves in the tank without putting too much weight on their wrists or messing up the suspension in turning? And then you ask, good question, Jim, can you fill us in? And I'm like, no. I mean, okay, granted, I raced. But, Jules, you know that I always raced a small bike. And, well, not always. I did some endurance races on larger bikes. But I was never one to fit in. And I think his example of Colin Edwards as being somebody that only locks, basically locks himself with one knee. Now, what we have to remember is that the adjustability on each of these bikes, that being the length of the seat from the back of the tank, the bar position, all of the stuff on GP bikes, is, and of course the foot pegs, are massively adjustable. And everything is a compromise, of course. And we of course saw that over the length of last season with Rossi. You know, they moved everything around all over the planet, trying to.
They ran out of.
They did
places to move it to.
They ran out of planet, right?
Yeah.
But still, each guy has their own unique way. The stuff that we learn in California Superbike School, or the stuff that we learn through Simon's video, that's the kind of stuff that gets ingrained on you when you're a young rider, when you're a young racer, and you're bringing yourself, or you know, Yamaha Championships Racing School, whatever. That's the kind of stuff that you learn and you adapt to your own technique as you are growing and maturing as a rider. What works for you as you move up into the ranks, and I think I actually had this conversation with Ben, Ben Spies, when we talked a few weeks ago. Where did you get your technique from? And in fact, I had a conversation with Colin about this as well. What is the biggest influence on your technique? And it turns out that the people that influenced them were the guys that were way back. They were way back in the day. There were guys that they saw doing A, B, and C, and they said, okay, we'll try that. And in Colin's case, it was Dirt Guide. This is stuff that you figure out the way that your body works and the way that you feel most comfortable on the bike. And you don't change. If you do, you change very little. When you find yourself arriving in the GP ranks, after, you know, a national superbike title or world superbike title, you're mostly locked in. You know, you hear guys talking about, you hear Rossi talking about this, you hear Casey, everybody talking about it, about the thousands. You know, Danny said the same thing. I've figured out how to adjust my technique. Bullshit. You haven't yet. Because your technique over time was adjusted to the 800s. And you have to make those very subtle refinements, because you are essentially, by this point of your career, you're locked in. You're not making big changes. The changes that you can make when you're hauling freaking ass on a 325 mile or kilometer an hour motorcycle, your instinct is still there, and you still are going to be doing what your brain, what your mind, what your wrist, and your body tells you to do. You can make subtle little changes, and you're going to have to force yourself to do it, but your technique is your technique. There's a reason we see Colin Edwards looking like a stork, you know, looking around corners. He's never going to change that. There's a reason why we see Valentino Rossi looking to see if his front tire is going flat in the middle of a corner. These guys do what they do, and they do what they do because they know it's worked for them. I don't know how much I can put it more than that from my experience, but that's my personal opinion of what I can see these guys doing from my limited racer's perspective.
Cool, man. Well, I think it's awesome. It sounds right to me.
Okay. I made it up, and hopefully that actually makes sense.
I sit up and luck in. Okay, and then Greg Hankins wrote in and said he's never been to a MotoGP race. Going to Laguna this year. Where's the place? Best place to sit? Is there such a thing as a paddock package? So he's just starting early this year because we usually get them a little later on in the season. But
like a week beforehand.
Exactly. We usually get them about Indy because Indy's definitely, you know, you kind of get locked into your choice if you want to sit in the grandstand. So the first thing I would suggest is don't bother getting a grandstand seat because it's a small track. It's a place where you could, during the race, you could walk around and see a lot of different things. But the best place really is to be up on the hill with the corkscrew behind you and perhaps walk over for the start, because when the bikes are still together and they're going through the corkscrew, it's like an incredibly beautiful sight to see the wave going through there. And but then you know if you sit on top of the hill opposite with a corkscrew behind you, you get to see pretty much everything except T6, T7, the corkscrew obviously, and T9. Everything else is right there. You'll be able to see them going down the straight, through the hairpin, 3, 4, you know, 5, where Jorge will probably get launched into space. and he also asks if there's such a thing as a paddock package, and Laguna Seca is one of the only tracks that actually sells paddock passes, because they have this weird setup. We've talked about this before, but they have this setup where the garages, where the bikes are, and where the RVs are. There's a space in between, and they let the fans go in there. I don't know what the price is going to be yet, but it's been like, you know, between $50 and $75, I think.
Well,
gives you a pass that, and it's limited. There's a limited number of them, so you have to get on that pretty quickly. They do sell out every year.
I do have some late breaking news because I got a newsletter today from Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca, and they have a package that is actually hella cheap, dude. It's $140 for the 3-day pass and a paddock pass.
Oh, nice.
And that includes your choice of seating if you in either the turn 4 or turn 11 grandstand. That's a pretty good
deal. An amazing deal, because normally it's $90 for the 3 days.
Yes,
and another $50 to $70 for the paddock pass, another $10 for the grandstand.
And they had on top of that, you could get motorcycle parking included for the 3 days for I think $190 total. Which,
wow. What a deal, man. That's awesome.
That is a smoking deal. So if those of you that hear this, go to, and I don't think it's any special URL, I'm sure, just go to, you know, look up Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca or Laguna Seca Raceway on Google, find their ticket section, because I bet these are going to go fast. It's a smoking deal. And I saw that, and back in the day when we actually had to buy tickets, I would have been all over.
Shut up.
You got skunked out of a parking this last year. You were kind of peeved. We won't go there, right?
No, we will not go there. But Greg, since you're going to Laguna Seca, just remember to listen in, because we're going to be having a meetup. It'd be awesome to meet you.
Of course. And you know, one of the things that Jules and I are working on this year are trying to get to more and more races, which means hopefully more and more meetups, right?
Yep.
Yep. I am not going to miss Indy this year. I'm not going to. I am going hell or high water.
Cool. You can drive out there, dude.
Yeah, besides, it's the cheapest race in the States. It's cheaper than going to Laguna for me.
In a way, actually, it's true.
Although I do have to go to Laguna because Mark's already said that he's going to go to Laguna with me.
Dude,
so
we're going to freaking Laguna. Come on. We're going to Laguna.
It's a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
What else should we talk about? I do want to massively thank – this is just a bits and pieces from the listeners that have written in. We have had a whole bunch of very interesting email and, frankly, a ton of great commentary on – the Facebook fan page, and that's been super active as well. In fact, it's keeping up with the both of them is a little crazy, isn't it?
Oh, speaking of which, because it's been on both on Facebook and lots of emails. Yes, Mark Miller's video with the D800, it's out. Yeah,
yes,
is. We'll include a link in the show notes for those of you who have not noted this fact. Although I think that's a very small number given the number of emails we've gotten about it and Facebook posts. I think it's awesome that everybody's so excited about seeing it because it is actually really cool seeing Mark, you know, in such a well produced video. It's like a short film. It is a short film, you know.
I've actually been fascinated by heading to the various because it's been very popularized in a lot of different forms, some motorcycle and some not, and going and reading the commentary on it. From both a motorcyclist and non-motorcyclist perspective, and just there's very polarized opinions on it.
Well,
Mark and I have talked about it a bunch of times in email.
It's a pretty shitty film.
No, yeah,
Mark's awesome in it.
No. I he and I are pretty much in agreement that it's a very cool thing to do, and we think it's well done. But
the story's ass.
Yeah. I've just been fascinated by how weird people react to it because there's so many people who react to it purely from a photography point of view. There's people that react to it from a motorcyclist point of view, non-racing, and there's people that react to it from a racing point of view. There's like all these different and just go wow. It's really weird to see like the communities clash. I've been amused, I have to say.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
It's definitely worth watching. Especially the first bits with him on the bike. Later on, they should have done more with him on the bike, and then it would have been kick ass.
Yeah, that's what he said. My first comment to him.
Mark on the bike.
When he asked, as I said. What I really wanted to see was because you know with the when we talked and we talked about the thing at length was more him sliding the back end and the I told him the best representation I actually got of it was the sound of the tire sliding which was actually very cool but overall I thought it was cool. In fact the making of was very cool as well.
We should link both of those.
We should. And boo on Nikon for getting mad at him for having that comment, the chat with us. But, in the end, I think it probably did them a world of good to get that out into a different world, right? You know, expose.
You sure you want to talk about that on the show?
Yeah. No, I'm totally cool about it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. We're quite both settled on it.
All right.
Let's get
to GP stuff.
Okay.
I don't want to go down these lists of testing,
yep.
but I did want to point out, so we had Moto 2 and Moto 3 testing over the last couple of weeks. And in Moto 2, the thing I wanted to note about this stuff is check out Kalex, man.
Oh, I know.
Everybody, this is what's so cool about you know, the I guess the age of Moto 2 is it's so young that there's these massive shifts. I mean, last year we had three KLX bikes,
right?
And this year it's like
last year we had three KLX bikes and
And a KLX winner, GP, you know, the champion. And lots of suitors.
Yeah.
There's KLX all over the place. I mean, it's amazing.
And if you remember the conversation that I had with Scott Redding, and we talked about this a bit, why they shifted away. And I think that was kind of telling. I think others on the grid may have also done the same thing. That may be the reason why I'm having difficulty getting Eskil Suter on the phone. I think it's very interesting that we have had that shift. And even though, you know, we're still in the very earliest stages of testing right now for Moto 2 and Moto 3, both of which share, you know, a lot of the same characteristics and a lot of the same chassis manufacturers, it's it is interesting to watch. Now, we do know that Valencia was kind of unusual in its circumstance until the third day, and that it was very cold and conditions weren't ideal, and people were just, you know, still sorting their bits out. But I think in the end,
dude, they're going to go to England.
Yeah, but true. I think in the end, though, we did get a decent idea of what we were going to potentially see at the front. And I think the biggest surprise for me, even though it was a one-off, was Paul Espargaró pipping Scott Redding at the end with a brilliantly blazing fast time.
Yeah. But we know Paul is fast.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, if you read the names at the top, it's great. Espargaró, Redding, Iannone, Corsi, Cordy, Simone, Luthi, Esteve Rabat, and Gino Rea, which is great.
Yeah.
Although, is he really signed?
No, he's not signed yet.
He's not signed yet, yeah. Well, Calio Angeles, I mean, it's like, you know, it's a who's who of Moto2.
And it's the suspects have started to sort themselves out. I will point out that, you know, Redding led the first 2 days, and the one thing that he did do, and that Espargaró didn't, was he ran an entire series of laps, a full race simulation, which has been his weak point in the past, at record laps the whole way. And that's something, you know, Espargaró had a great one-off. So, you know, bragging rights and all that, but I think Redding is going to be a force to be reckoned with. And I did kind of chuckle because that was... I'm very amused by how the teams are becoming more, the teams and folks are becoming a little bit more, there's a little bit more braggadocio going on Twitter these days, some of which has gotten people into trouble. HR's in a little bit of trouble for that. Got a little over cocky and had a little bunch of people jump on him, when they were trying to kind of do the stoner, I think that might have been a bit of a misstep, but I think this is going to be interesting. And I look at the people that actually ran really well in Moto2, and I think it's that chart is going to be something we need to keep an eye on. I think it's also very interesting that there were teams that were holding back times until for the full test period. Or until the end of the test period and, like, release teams on the last day. I think one that really sticks out of my mind that we were kind of all waiting for was in Moto3, with the new Repsol signing of Maverick Vinales. What a great... they didn't release any times until the last day, and then they're like, oh, yeah, he was a tenth off of the fastest time. Oh, there you go. Merry Christmas. Very, very interesting. The riders that we saw at the top there were a little bit more mixed up, Jules, and a couple of names in there that might be a little bit surprising, but still, actually, I do find it surprising. I have to say it's a bit more of a mishmash. Just running down, like, the top 10 guys, Sandro Fattesi, Maverick Vinales in second, Alberto Moncoyo, Danny Kent, Luis Salom, Nicolas Ajo, where's he from?
Don't know.
National. Okay. Hector Faubel, Miguel Oliveira. This one's going to be tough. Zulfami Karudin. I'm probably fairly close. He's sponsored by AirAsia, so maybe from Malaysia, perhaps. Brad Binder, Efren Vasquez, Luis Rossi, and the list goes on. Some different names up there.
Yeah, but you know what? Remember Moto 2 year one.
Oh yeah.
Look how many people we met because of that. Look how many people as fans we heard of that we'd never heard of before, and including people like Tamazawa, you know?
Right, right.
You know, I mean it's a great time to for a lot of writers who didn't get a chance to shine before to shine.
Right, right. Yeah. I again, you know, it's funny. We didn't balk at all this year when it came to Moto 3. We're like, okay, yeah, it's going to happen. So let's get into it and just see what it does. And so far, their times are very, very close, and actually closer to the 125 times than Moto 2 was to the 250s right off the bat. So I think we're going to be seeing some very serious competition, especially as those bikes get dialed in. I will point out that in the Moto 2 ranks, and I believe it's the exact same thing in the Moto 3 ranks, not everybody has their full spec configuration right yet. Moto 2 is probably more complete because it's obviously been around for a while. Moto 3, I think there's still some people that weren't running, didn't have the spec ECUs available. So that equation may get shifted around a bit as time goes on. But of course, it is still test zero, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So all of this is with plenty of grains of salt, but it's a salt shaker that I think may shake out very well.
Okay. I'm just excited. It's they're out on track. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, speaking about out on track, we've also got World Superbike stuff. But a couple of things just to fill that out. Next test for these guys, basically starts, what is it? Tomorrow
or
today when the show is going to make it out. 3-day test, 16th, 17th, and 18th at Jerez. And that being further south may give folks better conditions. You know, who knows? We will certainly talk about that next week when we'll have even more to talk about. And then I'll see if I can't source out some interviews with some folks and get you guys some more detailed information.
Now, this is the exciting bit because we're getting very close to the start of the racing season, even though it's kind of a fake one because it's so early and then they're going to take a big break. But we got Superbikes coming up in just over a week at Phillip Island.
Yeah, yeah. This is the private testing that's going on right now. And to be frank, I'm coming out of it and coming into this conversation just kind of going, shit. because there are a few things that happened, and I think we might as well address those right off the bat before we get to what really happened that aren't so good, Jules. John Hopkins, day one, end of his first session, crashes in turn one, one of the hairiest corners on the entire GP calendar. You're going in there at
max speed, pretty much.
Yeah. You're entering at about 190 miles an hour, 315 kilometers. And it's very precise. And we all know that Phillip Island has its foibles and winds and things going on, and things can happen. Well, John Hopkins got cut out at the end of his first session, crashed, broke, and poor guy, rebroke, I guess the knuckle above the same finger that he injured last year at the Brno World or Wild Card round, and that he had partially amputated this year, and is going to miss that. So coming in for him out of British Superbike is Josh Brooks to substitute for him, which, by the way, makes me completely rethink my MCN Fantasy League because he's going to PI. I'm like, do I really want to have him on my BSB team as well? just a thought. And then on top of that, on the last day, Eugene Laverty had a head shake coming down the front straight at PI, knocking his brake pads back. Not an uncommon occurrence, but may not have gotten pumped up before going into turn one. Went off circuit and broke the fifth modern tarsal in his left hand. Got a pretty good elbow contusion. Got his bell rung pretty well. Apparently that's already been cleared. I saw a photo of him. He's iffy for race one at PI. He's staying down there. He was initially thinking he might go back to the UK to talk to a specialist, but he thinks he's going to stick down there and see if he can suss it out and maybe make it through the test or wait until things go on. There were a couple other guys that got hurt, and there were some pretty big offs, people wearing the rust off over the off season. And so we're not starting things off on the best foot.
Those guys anyway.
There are others.
Carlos Checa.
Tom Sykes. Guys that, well, Sykes, he, you know, it wasn't raining, and he spent some good time at the top of the timesheets. Good on him that ZX-10 is finally maturing. Carlos Checa aboard the 1098, by the way, because the 1199 Panigale is not currently homologated for World Superbike, just for Super Stock 1000. And Ducati said that early, so nobody freak out. We're up there at the top. Leon Haslam, Max Biaggi, Johan Lescors, Jakob Smirts, the list goes on. This might be sorting itself out as well. This is the unofficial test that ran. So next week is the official test. And the gloves will come off or go on tighter. And I think we'll have a better idea. What do you think?
Aside from the... I just can't get over the fact that that Hopkins got hurt again. I mean, this guy's... The universe is just conspiring against him. And he's... He was so freaking on last year, and it seems like that little side trip to Brno started off like a chain reaction of just crap, you know.
To be honest, he never recovered from that.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think that it's just compounding of that same freaking injury.
The very key thing for him is that John needs to keep his spirit up and keep his head straight as he works through this. The goal right now is to be healthy and cool for Imola, and so he's definitely not going to be running at PI.
Yep.
And get things finished up, healed up. You know, take off the rest of the finger if you need to, dude. I'm joking about that, John. And just be prepared. You know, any of the other injuries that have occurred. And there were some other big offs. I mean, there were guys that were getting together out there. There were problems with wallabies on the track. There were problems, of course, with the typical water that foul the track. Classic PI stuff. I heard on the final day, the track temperature was way high. It was like 55 centigrade. That's smoking hot. So could be interesting, but remember, as I said, this is, you know, we had Superstock guys out there mixed in with the World Superbike guys. Next week is going to be the real deal. And so we're going to have all the Supersport guys down there. And a lot of teams that Chris Pike is a classic example. You know, we don't see any times from Johnny Ray. Well, their equipment's down there. And he and I have talked a bit as this week has gone on. You know, they're still back at home, comfortable and relaxed. These were teams that went down and wanted to try and get a little bit of extra time in. So, next week's going to be, we're going to have a lot to talk about next week.
By the way, I just got to say about the Chris Pike interview, I really enjoyed hearing how hard he was trying to be PR, Mr. PR. It was great.
I was like a crowbar, wasn't I?
Oh, yeah. I know. You just would not let him go get away with it. It was great. I really enjoyed it.
It was fun. He gets me. So I'm going to do that. And we actually know each other from one of the most raucous forums online. And he wouldn't do an interview with me for a couple of years. I think he's like, oh shit.
And he knew that you could pull out some evil stuff from the.
The only way that I actually got this.
The evils of internet past.
Was to, you know, person to person face him down at the GT. And I'm like, okay, you can't run away now.
But
so cool. So cool.
Chris, you're great. We love having you on the show. And as much as we'd like to give you a bit of stick, you're a good guy. We enjoy talking to you.
So, Jim, I got a question for you.
Right.
Give me a prediction of something that will happen this year in Superbikes that hasn't happened before.
Huh. Okay. Interesting. We will see. Okay.
Do you think we will, for example, will we see Kawasaki win a dry race? Will we see a BMW win a race finally?
Yes, on both.
Yes, on both?
Yes, on both.
I definitely think BMW will. They've got such an awesome team. And Tom Sykes has been amazing. So if that ZX-10 delivers on the promise, I can see that too.
The answer to your question, mm-hmm, is I think what we're going to see this year, which I think is going to be really exciting, is I don't think we're going to see a dominant team like we've seen, a dominant team that wins
most of the races,
majority of races.
Yeah.
And on top of that, I think we're probably going to have some very surprise winners, even in dry races. I would not be surprised if, and I think the team has the capability of pulling it off, and I've been kind of following behind the scenes as to a particular gentleman's training, one Jakob Smerts, win a race.
Oh, man. It's been coming for so long.
How many races has he led, dude?
Oh, I know, exactly. Exactly.
And Jakob, frankly, that's me also cheering you on. Because...
And that is a great team. You're absolutely right. They really are. They really do put together
they do.
A great package.
And they've got a Canuck running there. Brett McCormick out of the Canadian Superbike Series is running. They're running the 1098s in World Superbike with Jakob and who else is it? Help me out here.
Gentile?
Yeah, Gentile.
Yep.
Who's sporting a beard right now. He kind of looks like Jakob, frankly.
Look at that frickin' hipster.
Yeah, I know. the French-Englishman, Anglo-Franco. They're running the 1098s, but in Superstock they're running the 1199s. So there's a kid that's come out of Canada that went over to do a test at Portimao, just kind of on a one-off thing. And they actually had a different rider in mind, and he kicked ass at Portimao, and they said, all right, well, then you take the ride. So there's a guy out of Canada that's going to be racing the 1199 Panigale for their Superstock, because they got two bikes in Superstock.
Very cool.
Yeah, and it is kind of weird that they're going to run the 1199s, but I kind of understand that, because in the Superstock series, that will give Ducati an opportunity to figure out what breaks and what doesn't, right?
Right. Yeah, they need that thing on a racetrack under proper race conditions like that.
There's a really great mix of bikes in Superstock 1000. We've got 1199s, 1098s, Hondas, a bunch of Kawasaki's, BMWs, a few Hondas, not many Yamahas. It's all about who's offering support, but. It'll be interesting. BMW dominated last year. It'll be interesting to see if the 1199 can kind of stack the deck in the, I think there's six of them, in the field. You know, I rarely watch thousand Superstock, but every time I talk to people that watch it, you know, especially Whittem, he's like, oh, did you see that race? And sometimes I lie and go, yeah, it was good. but I need to start watching those. Because it sounds to me like that they have a tendency to be some very, very epic races.
Yeah. Plus, you know, that's the best way to learn about who's up and coming.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of those guys actually stepped in. It's kind of an interesting series because some of them don't always, but you usually get guys that cross over. A lot of the guys that are in there often end up in World Endurance.
And it's really been weird this year, especially because we obviously everybody knows out there that the economy has been playing havoc with riders and teams, and that is, Jules, the bottom line why the silly season is still to this fucking day going on.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, literally.
I mean, we have time some Ginnarea on the Moto2 bike, yeah. And he's not even signed with the team yet.
You see guys getting rides, losing rides. Ant West is a classic example. That's been a bit of a drama, hasn't it?
Well, let's get on to that.
Okay.
Because that's my favorite bit of news of the week. not him losing the ride, because that sucks for him. But I'm just so excited about who's going to Swan.
I want to know how much money they had to pay Norihaga to step onto the Swan Yamaha. That gentleman, oh man, that must have cost a pretty bit of coin. But Norihaga
and Tommy Hill at Swan Yamaha, it's going to be amazing. I mean, freaking Samurai of Slide on some of those tracks. Yep. Wow, it is going to be incredible to watch those races.
You know, there's a lot of people saying they want to see him go over the mountain at Cadwell, and actually want to see him go through those fussy little bits before they come back down the straight. The mountain's neat and it's pretty and all that. And it's funny, you know, like
sure.
See them launch, but that little bit of goat trail before they come onto the front straight to me is just the most fascinating part. There's other places, Olden Park. I mean, you know, raging around Brands.
He's got that crazy style with the. The super turning that he has that nobody else can ride. Yeah. He's going to reinvent some lines around those tracks that never been tried.
Let's put this in perspective too. This is the first year there where they're running essentially in the superbike class, but it's the Evo spec. So these are spec ECU bikes. They're super stock bikes on steroids. And so the racing is going to be tighter. There's no doubt. And certainly the Yamaha performs well in that mode. The other teams, most particularly Aprilia, although Mark Miller and I were talking because Splitbath, who basically, bless their hearts, but the Aprilia was having issues last year. I'll put it like that.
Nice.
Mark Wittage of PTR, who was running Eugene's team, is going to be doing, through his new company, all the tuning for that team. And so they're going to have some kick-ass engines with some well-done electronics, and I wouldn't be surprised to see that team step up. There are some other interesting pairings within the BSB paddock. It's going to be like a new year, much like, I think, there's going to be a lot of unpredictability. And I don't think until things really get underway, and the teams have a tendency not to test or release a whole lot of information prior to the season starting, which is coming up fairly soon.
Yep.
And we do have the extra bonus this year, BSB running at Assen. It's been a while since I actually ran a race out of country. So
they're using the entire Assen circuit the same as Superbikes and MotoGP, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that I guess we're mentioning BSB is this much is because we do have our MCN Fantasy League going on, where you have to know BSB, folks, even if you're American. And last I checked, which was about an hour ago, we were up over 150 folks, and I'm sure if I checked my email now, there'd be another 8 or 9 or so. I think we're probably going to end up with 250 plus before we get started, and that means from the time that this show comes out, if you jam it out tomorrow or whenever, we've got, 10 days left? Nine days?
Well, you don't have to join our league to sign up, so just get your ass in gear, sign up, and then you can join after the thing starts. So it's as long as you get your team together before the first race.
Really well. And then I might be picky. If right. You're running in number one and you say, oh, hi, I don't know you, but I want to join your league, I might.
Right. You gotta mention who was interviewed on episode 230 or something like that, you know?
Well done, Jules. No. You have to quote an outtake from like episode, 286 or something.
Oh, evil. There you go. So there you go. So we're gonna sign up, I think, because we don't have anything else to talk about, and let's not drone on for no reason. Jim's gonna possibly get something in, but probably we'll just roll this thing into a quick one. And put everything, all the good stuff next week. I've got a surprise coming for next week, but I don't want to talk about it because it might not happen. But definitely tune in next week.
Well, tune in next week anyway.
Well, of course. Of course. Tune in next week. And thanks, Jim. It's good to talk to you again.
Oh, yeah, it's been a while. Thanks, everybody out there, for listening to the show. Very, very stoked to always have you here, of course. Thanks for participating as well on the Facebook fan page, and all of you donors, massive thanks, and that's extremely helpful. We can't tell you how much it is. Join us at facebook.com/motopod. You can email us through the motopodcast.com website, or
follow us on Twitter.
Twitter as well. We're unfortunately ubiquitous, Jules. We're everywhere and nowhere at once. I guess that might be the perfect description for our radio show, isn't it?
Exactly. We're just a bunch of waves.
All right, folks. Thanks a bunch. And we will talk to you next week.
Excellent. Ciao.
Later.
Come on! Into the corkscrew! Side by side! It's like the last lap. Oh, and he's on the grass! They're going to touch! Ducati are having kittens at the moment.
They're at the top of the hill. 12 and 13 to go. Lorenzo still leads the way. Rossi very, very close indeed. They clutch down the hill. We ride with Valentino Rossi. Lorenzo now into turn 13. And Rossi invented something in the final corner. And Lorenzo gets close to the back. And Rossi has beaten him. Through turn 14 they come, the very last bend of the season. And Casey Stoner tried to pull up alongside Benjamin.
Oh, it could be Stoner! It's Stoner who wins! Coming out of the final corner, I do not believe it!